All right. So today I want to make a few comments about the Kenyan perspective, the opposite of the Nezek perspective. Did anybody actually have a chance to read the article that I emailed out from Benson?
Yeah, I read it.
I haven't read it yet.
So I just want to read one passage from that article. The article is actually trying to figure out, you know, whether contracts in general share a similar basis with torts, whether there's a separate basis for liability in contracts. Now, on page, I think, 44 of that article. Let me see. No. See, right now, my copy is missing those pages. Ben, did you have a chance to look at that yet, or...?
When was this one sent out?
A few weeks ago. You skimmed it, right?
I read it, yeah. What's it called? I'm trying to find it.
Benson on contracts. It's like a summary of different views about... Yeah, so here. This is page 40 to 41 in the article, I think. Just give me 1 second. He calls this, Benson calls it a transfer theory of contract, whereby a contract alienates one's rights to another person. And the important point here is that a contract is basically like a transfer of property. That was the important paradigm that he appealed to. So on page 41 of the article, he says that...
Barnett.
Yeah. So Barnett begins from the premise that respect for our freedom of action requires that we have principles to govern the rightful acquisition, use, and transfer of the relatively scarce resources which we want and need. So contracts could be a principle of transfer of stuff. Okay. So these principles establish moral boundaries, the very last line on 40, and they mark a domain within which the right holder is relatively free to do as she wishes with the object of her entitlement. She may use it or transfer it as she wills. So we all have rights, and we have this power to transfer our rights. Whereas property specifies the principles governing the acquisition of entitlements, and tort law concerns their protection and use, contract deals with the valid transfer of entitlements between persons. So we're thinking of contract as a way of transferring rights. Okay. One second. Mm-hmm. Here. And then on page 42, a promiser in breach can be viewed, in the middle of the page, not merely as failing to confer a benefit on the promisee, but as interfering with what already belongs to the promisee in virtue of their contract. So if I hire Yoni as my poel and then I breach, so it's not just that I fail to confer a benefit of providing the service to Yoni, but rather I've interfered with what already belongs to Yoni in virtue of the contract, thereby making enforcement consistent with the idea of misfeasance and an award of expectation damages truly compensatory. So now when we say that Yoni's entitled to the value of the contract, it's not that he's getting something new. He's just being compensated from what he was deprived of because he already owns that He already owns the entitlements that the contract transferred to him. Does everybody see that idea? This idea can be seen if we consider the structure of a present gift or exchange through which ownership is transferred. So the paradigm on this view for a contract is a transfer of ownership. If the transferor's alienation of ownership is not joined by the transferee's receipt, title to the thing may remain with the transferor. So what distinguishes a property transfer from a contract transfer? He says, in contrast to transfer of property, the essential feature of contract is that it can be binding, and hence correlative rights and duties can be created prior to performance. Right? So in the only thing that distinguishes a contract from a property transfer is that in a sale, so it's when I give you the object, that generates the duty to pay. Whereas a contract has the ability to generate obligations even prior to the actual provision of the service. So a kinyan would have the power to generate these obligations. You don't need the actual physical transfer of the thing. So he says in the fourth to last line in that paragraph, second to last paragraph from 42. So if you view contract as a transfer theory, then it's going to present a contract as giving the promisee possession prior to performance. Possession that cannot be physical. You see that, guys? Do you get the...
I'm a little confused in his, formulation, whether he's thinking that when you transfer, are you transferring the final product, really akin to like the actual...
You're transferring the rights, I think.
The rights. No, I'm saying, are you transferring the rights to the final product, and then I, you know, contribute to build the building, so... Effectively, now I owe the building is just going to be built in a year or two. Or is it that I've been transferred, so to speak, the abstract, like the responsibility to build the building?
I think the latter. But you just view the latter as a kind of a physical object.
Mm-hmm. But it's not that the end result is what you require.
Right.
It's just like the...
Right, the rights, the entitlements to it.
The entitlements that you require to build the building.
Right, the legal relations. So, but the important point here is that you view contract as a subset of transfer of ownership, like property transfer. Just, you know, contract deals with more abstract things, and even before there's a physical transfer, there's a legal transfer of ownership. Okay, that's one thing I wanted to bring out from the Benson article, and you'll see how it plays out in a lot of the Rishonim in our sugya. So let's look at that. Let's look at how this plays out in our sugya. So turn in the source sheet to page 17. You can see the Ramban in Bav Metzia, Ayin Vav Mebeis, the Ramban that we've seen several times. So I think the Ramban is clearly working within this paradigm when he says that once there's haschala samalacha, kivan she'eschilu b'malacha, neschayev me'achsha litin lahem schar and mishalim, kemo she'kibel alav. So schiras polim, once there's haschala samalacha, there's a chiyuv to give him the full amount. Shekishem sheshar hadvarim niknin bekinyan kach schiras polim niknes baschalas malacha. I think that analogy, right, speaks very much to this idea in the Benson article that yeah, contract is just like a transfer of property. Kishem sheshar hadvarim niknin bekinyan kach schiras polim niknes baschalas malacha. And that's why once there's haschalas malacha, you're nischayev me'achshav litin lehem schar and mishalim. You're obligated under a theory of kinyan, not tort, to give what you already transferred legally to the other party. Okay. Now, the practical nafkamina we saw is twofold, that the Ramban himself is... the primary nafkamina is the following, that if we're dealing with a theory of tort, what do you have to check in order to make sure that there are, in fact, damages? What do you always have to check?
Your alternative.
Yeah, the counterfactual alternative. Wrong. A counterfactual alternative. You don't have to do that when it comes to a chiyuv of collecting under the contract. It's already there, as the Ramban says. Shmamina, there's the top of page 18. Da'afilu lo hayamotze mitchila schiros kla chayiv. Right, you're still going to be chayiv, even if the polem could not have found alternative employment, and therefore there's no real hafsid. Shulchan Aruch, I think, is working with this paradigm also in Shin Lamed Gimel Beis. I think the Shulchan Aruch gets it from the Magen Mishnah. The Magen Mishnah got it from the Ramban. That there's a fundamental difference between the pre-Kinyan basis for a collection, which is tort, and the post-Kinyan basis for collection, which is contract. And the Haraya, or the Nafkamina, being that you don't need to check the counterfactual to see if there was any hafsid. Pischei Choshen, on the bottom of page 18, you can see this in Parak Yud Sif Zayin. He cites the Shulchan Aruch that once there's Aschalas HaMalacha Yerchai B'Torah Kinyan, and he says, V'kol Shekein L'achar She'asu Kinyan Al HaSchiros. Right, and all the more so if it was a formal Kinyan, not this more artificial Kinyan of Aschalas HaMalacha. So whether there's a formal Kinyan or Aschalas HaMalacha, both of those are going to be sufficient to generate liability under the contract theory. Okay.
Itamar.
Yes.
This will put pressure on some of the Ramban's other ideas. But it's not true that the test of liability in torts is the counterfactual. Because there are cases where the damage would have occurred anyway, and you're still liable.
Where the damage would have occurred anyway, and you're still liable.
Yeah. We discussed these cases last year where, like, you were the first negligent party and your contribution was sufficient. That's a tour for the second guy who was also negligent. You occupy the field. Counterfactually, the damage would have happened anyway, but the first guy is still liable. So it can't be that.
Right. Well, there might be a difference between the counterfactual where the damage would have happened anyway and the counterfactual where the damage would not have happened but for your hefsid. But it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question whether this principle is going to be fully consistent with the other.
I think you're just going to have to appeal to a. Because all this does is say that the Ramban, might need to find it. So there are such cases. I don't think that there's a, in terms of it from a counterfactual perspective, from the perspective of the counterfactual analysis, I don't think there will be much of a divergence, except this, like, primitive, unless you just, want to, take the contract as the premise, which I think is the right thing to do anyway, it'll mean some concessions down the road for the Ramban. That's okay for me, but you're not going to get there on the modal, you can't scotch the torts analysis on the grounds that, there's a liability in the contract case.
Well, I'm just saying, right? I think you're raising an important point about how this application of the counterfactual test coheres with the counterfactual test in other areas of Nezikin. That's a bit of a side issue for our analysis, because for our analysis, the Rishonim are saying, on the assumption that liability here is tort based, check the counterfactual. But on the assumption that it's Kinyan based, you don't have to check the counterfactual. So these Rishonim are very explicit that distinction matters.
So I guess the problem is that the Ramban is going to be using that distinction even within the even once the contract has begun. The Ramban is going to be using the duty to mitigate has gotten to a mode.
But okay, but we're not talking yet about the duty to mitigate. We're talking about whether counterfactually, at the time that you hired him, did he have other opportunities to get labor that you deprived him of?
No, I understand. All I'm saying is that the
hold off on the duty to mitigate, because we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Everybody's basic. That's just the basic Ramban so far.
Is the point I'm making general?
Well, I see what you're getting at in the duty to mitigate, and we'll approach that in a second. So the first important shita that I want to... So that's the Ramban, that sets the background for this discussion. What's really important for our purposes right now is the shitos that really nail down the view that we're dealing with a full contract theory. So look here at the bottom of page 18, you have the Chaznishim Bava Kama Simen Chaf Gimel. I think the Chaznish takes a very strong view on what the contract theory is. So Yoni, why don't you read it for us?
From the beginning?
Yeah. Why don't I get, let's see if I get, Yakir, are you here? Let me see if I get Yakir.
Yeah, I'm here.
Do you see the Chazon Ish? On the bottom of page 18?
I can see it.
Yeah, do you want to read it for us?
Sure.
Go for it.
All right. Near the Hiskel Mulacha, Chazar Baal Bayis, the Dinu de Chayb Lashalim, Kol Scharo, Afilim Lohia Poal Motilis Dakar Amesh, Afilis Schar Biosem, Rizkar Poalim. Tarzem is Char Poal Mamish, Mulu Garmi, Vimiyachal Asalko, Vimitatlin, Vashkas of Ashach. The Mies Baal Bayis, Govim Yorsha, Vimiyach Achreis Nechasim,
Yeah, really interesting point of the Chazanish. So, Yair, what do you take to be the main points of the Chazanish here?
The main point of the Chazanish is just that the payment here is actually the payment of the wages.
Yeah. Right, so in a case of breach, where the Baal HaBayis is Chozer after Kenyan, not only is the measure of damages the amount that the Poel would have made had he completed the job, but also the modality of the payment is as if the payment were rendered for services completed. And it has all the dinim of schar pu'ula that the Torah assigns, that the Torah requires when you make payment to a poel. So, yeah, okay, what are some of those dinim that the Chazanish points to?
So all the things he says, I'm not sure exactly what it means. I guess
so yes, there's a special din when it comes to Schiras Poelim that you can't pay him in Shava Kesef. Some Achronim explain that's because, you know, if the guy needs to provide food for his family, it's too difficult for him to exchange the Shava Kesef to buy dinner, so you got to pay him directly in Kesef.
Okay.
That's one din. And then the most...
The Arshim.
Yeah, and then third.
And you have to pay it on time.
That's right. So maybe there's a special halacha when it comes to poelim, biyomo titein scharo, baltalin, right? You can't withhold his wage until the next day. Ben, you're welcome to move out of the sun if you want.
I think
it's fine. Yeah, okay. So what do you make of this Chazanish? See, it's... He's definitely going in for the Kenyan theory, and you could see he even prefaces his remarks, oh, once there's Aschalas and Malacha, you pay automatically. It's not just about what you deprived him of had he, you know, found employment elsewhere. No, you got to pay him the amount of wages that you specified for him. And it has all the dinim of Schar Pu'ula. Right? Schar Zehu Schar Poel Mamish V'lo Garmi. And so therefore you can't pay Shavu Kesef and you have an Isser Bal Talin. So, Yakir, what do you make of this Chazanish?
It seems like kind of the reasonable extreme of taking this contract perspective.
Yeah, how extreme do you think this is, and how reasonable? Do you think there's room to disagree with the Chazanish here? I mean, could you go in for a Ramban-esque contract view without going all the way to the Chazanish that it has the din of Halana Schar Sachir, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you can certainly disagree on the details of these particular din that maybe Halana Schar Sachir only applies to payment for services actually provided.
100%. I agree with that. That's one way. That's one. You could disagree with the Chazanish, but he's going very far in saying, I don't know. We'll treat breach damages for breach as if, you know, the poel is getting paid for actual services. So he is going farther. Now,
it seems like he's decoupled the labor that you do and the payment that you receive for the labor, that they're unrelated. When you agree to a contract, you agree to pay regardless of the work that's done.
This is true. That is the. That is a descriptive way, I think, of characterizing the Chazanish's position. But why do you think he's saying this?
That's just how
you
understand how contracts operate?
Yeah, it does seem to be some theory of how contracts operate. You know, Gabe, I think your point is trying to say, well, you see that even with the contract, B'yomotitein schara has nothing to do with the work, it has to do with the eschaivus. I think that's a huge chiddush to say that, right? That b'yomotitein schara and halana schar sachir have to do with obligating yourself to pay a poel as opposed to the poel earning his income.
I agree with you. I think this is a radical idea, which I don't fully agree with. So,
yeah. I don't know. So what would you, how would you maybe use Hofeld here even to characterize where you think you might, what is the Chazon Ish conflating here?
Do you think that the Chazon Ish is conflating the right to the correlation of performance to payment with the secondary right to compensation in case of breach?
That's right. I think that's exactly right. Okay. That's a, and that's what Yoni just mentioned.
I think you can defend the Chazon Ish.
Yeah, I think. Let's, before we defend it, let's just say where you might disagree with the Chazon Ish. So I think Cole and Yoni are right that one place where you might resist the Chazon Ish and say is to say no, there's a distinction here between the primary duty of the contract, right, and the compensation, the secondary duty that arises in cases of breach, right? So it's true that the primary duty, had it have been fulfilled, would have been to pay biyomo titen scharo, et cetera, et cetera. That's gone. That ship has sailed, right? The primary rights and duties are no longer here. Now we're in secondary land, secondary rights and duties land, to figure out how to remedy for that wrongdoing. And you might say the remedy doesn't have all the dinim, the secondary rights and duties don't have all the dinim of the primary rights and duties. Right? So even within the contract theory, there's the hischaivos and the rights and duties of the primary contract, the primary rights and duties that arise under the contract. And then in the breach of those, there are secondary rights and duties that arise, and those would not have the dinim of biyomo titeim schara and shava kesef. Because what it really is, the secondary duties are ways of vindicating the wrongdoings or the breach of the primary rights and duties. They don't have to be identical. Chazon Ish seems to be arguing one of two things. Either he's just thinking that, if you go in for a contract theory, all you really have is a primary right and duty, primary rights and duties, and that's already what the poel owns. And I think this might be what Gabe was saying, that what the poel owns when the contract is transferred to him is the primary rights and duties, which include biyomo titein scharo and shava kesef. That's just what he acquires when he's kone the poel agreement. Or the Chazon Ish thinks that when you vindicate the primary rights and duties, you want the secondary ones to be as closely related to the primary ones as possible. And so what did the poel lose? The poel not only lost the amount of dollars, but he also lost the modality of how he was going to be paid them, biyomo and shava kesef. And so in a chanami, this is a secondary right and duty, but we wanted to represent as much as possible what he lost in the primary rights and duties that were his. So I think this is where the tension comes out with the Chazon Ish, and at least within the Hofeldian framework of the primary versus secondary rights and duties. Guys, have comments?
I think it doesn't seem like the Chazon Ish is distinguishing between primary and secondary. I mean, you got the two options you said, it sounds like the former, just based on the fact that he says it is schar zehu schar poel mamish.
Right. It sounds like he's saying that there's no secondary duty, right? Yeah. The poel already owns the obligations that the balabayis was mischayiv himself for and the primary obligations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a very good diakuk here. I think you're right in terms of the Chazon Ish's own intent. So the shaila is that because he's not being sensitive to the distinction between primary and secondary duties, or just because he's decided that when it comes to kinyan like schiras poelim or a kinyan like transfer, you own the entitlements, you own the rights that were transferred to you. Yeah. Anybody else have comments on this?
Yeah, I think this is, I don't know whether the Chazon Ish had read Hofeld, or was alive to the distinction that Hofeld articulated in his own writing. I do think that there is a good reason to... So the argument against the Chazanish is that, you know, we already have a distinction, we have a distinction already in the Gemara between, even in case where the Baal HaBayit has to provide compensation, between workers who perform and workers who don't perform. The Gemara already says that. And the Chazanish, or the Chazanish, is a bit of a chiddush, because you have to reject that distinction in the case where the contract has already begun. It's not that a huge chiddush if you think that that this is really a contract and not a torts question. Because if it's a contract and not a torts question, the period of contract is going to be qualitatively different from the period of non-contract. The way you could defend the Chazanish on the merit is by saying that the Polim shouldn't penalize the Polim for the Baal HaBayit is messing around.
That's right.
The contract, in a sense, the contract incurs to the Baal HaBayit. Let me put it this way. You're basically, the idea is that you're compensating them for their time. The modal analysis applies in this sense. They could have, if they could have been doing other things of the value that that they would have been receiving in wages before the Baal HaBayit retracted, it seems fair that if the Baal HaBayit is completely at fault, they receive that value anyway.
Yeah. So you're saying this is just like compensation for damages.
Right, exactly. That's the defense of the Chazanish.
Which is similar to what I was saying, that you want to...
Very intuitive.
You think that is intuitive. But I think
the Gemara is distinction intuitive, and I imagine that, it would apply.
You're talking about the Paul Bottel distinction.
Yeah, it's true. Performance, the compensation is for performance. And if you don't perform, then, in other words, let me put it this way.
So hold up. I think you're making an interesting point about... You're saying the Chazanish is somewhat in tension with the idea of Poel Batel, because you see you don't get the full value of the contract in that case.
Yeah, correct.
Right.
The Gemara already has this distinction, so the Chazanish has to earn his rejection of it.
Right. Good point. We're going to address Poel Batel shortly, and we'll see. I think there are different ways of understanding Poel Batel. Maybe one of them is conciliatory to the Chazanish's general approach. But does everybody understand Cole's point? Cole's making an interesting observation that the Chazanish who really taps the idea that this, as Yakir said, this is schar poel mamish, and that's why they get all the benefits and perks of as if they perform the labor, is going to run into some tension with the idea that the poelim generally only get paid kipoel bato. Because there you see that there's some reduction in compensation for their not having worked, which suggests that it can't be as if they performed all the labor, etc., etc. That's the tension that Cole is placing against the Chazanish. Yeah, Yoni.
Kind of related actually to Cole's point. It seems that whether you take between the two options when understanding the Chazanish, whether you correlate the primary and secondary duty as really being exactly equivalent, there is no secondary duty, versus saying there really is secondary duty, but it's just matched the equivalent.
Yeah.
That distinguished kind of, that like that those two options kind of like. Go well, so to speak, with what we were talking about with regard to the duty to mitigate, that the more you talk about the duty to mitigate being some extraneous din that's a little hard to understand, why is it happening, it's some separate compensatory rule, right, the more you're going to be inclined to say this is really a secondary duty, and therefore there are secondary restrictions and applications will be more messy. But if you want to suggest something we raised was that maybe really the duty to mitigate is really just a reapplication or a transfer of the original contract in just new terms.
So we're still in primary rights and primary land.
So I'm saying what the Chazanish would say on that issue would also bear weight.
Yeah.
I think would track very well to the same.
Good point, which is actually what we're going to see now. It's just the Chazanish's comments on the duty to mitigate. So good. Yeah, let's take a look at that. So let's take a look at this. So the other, and Cole was mentioning this also, the more you go in for a Nezek theory, the more you can make sense of the duty to mitigate. And I think the Nesivis had this formulation, the clearest formulation. The Nesivis said, if you can still mitigate and recover, you could stop your losses, then there just is no Nezek. Right? Liability only arises if you suffered a loss. Insofar as you can mitigate, fully mitigate, you've suffered no loss. So the duty to mitigate makes a lot of sense on the tort theory. It's much more difficult to understand on the contract theory. Right? The Poel acquired the contract already. He's entitled to his compensation. Why should he be saddled with the duty to mitigate? So I want to point out two things, and Cole was pushing this over the last few days, and I was talking to him. So the first is to remember that not everybody really accepts the duty to mitigate. And so the more you reject it, the more you're going to... the more you're motivated to reject the duty to mitigate, the more you're open to realize to accepting the contract theory. So just to remind you, so you recall that the Bach said, this is on page 20 in the Makor Rashit, the Bach in Simon Shin Lamed Gimel said, Harishus biyad ha-poalim, sh'im ha-bal ha-bayis omer lehem sh'yaskiru atzmam, v'hu yashem lehem kefi ha-tnai, v'heim enam rotzim, chayiv l'shayim lehem kepoel batel. So the Bach thought that the Poel has the right to decide whether he wants to mitigate and then have the Baal HaBayis reimburse him the difference between how much he was able to mitigate and the original value of his contract, or whether he just wants to not work at all and be compensated Kepoel Batel. So the Bach seems to say that the worker has the right to not mitigate and cash in on the Poel Batel option. See that? So the Bach's view is definitely open to a strong contract theory. Does the Poel have to mitigate? No, because he's entitled to collect under the contract. Another view that leaned in this direction, you'll recall, was the Nesivis and Simon Shin Lamed Gimel Dalid. Remember, one view in the Rama said that a Poel has a duty to mitigate even if it's harder work. The Nesivis had this question and said, isn't that inconsistent with the case of Schiras Batim, where if you have to leave a tenancy, you can't just put in other tenants who have a larger family than you have, because that's imposing an undue burden on the Baal HaBayis. So remember, the Nesivis said, how are these principles consistent? And his answer was to distinguish between our case, which is a case of Nezek, and therefore you have a duty to mitigate, and that case, which was a case of Kinyan, right? The Baal HaBayis in the Schiras Batim case had a Kinyan that you were going to pay him for the rent. And so when you're dealing under contract, you can't force the Baal HaBayis to mitigate his losses. Under a contract theory, you can't force somebody to mitigate. So the Pesachei Choshen said that l'chora, the Nesivis would have to agree that in a Schiras Poalim case, la'achar kinyan, there wouldn't be a duty to mitigate when the malacha is kveda. This is the Pesachei Choshen on page 20, working off that Nesivis. He says, once there's a kinyan, the Nesivis would have to concede that Schiras Poalim is just like Schiras Batim, in which case there wouldn't be a duty to mitigate. He says, unless you distinguish between a real kinyan and a kinyan garua of haschalas malacha. So this is interesting for other reasons. So you can see the Pesach Choshen says, v'tzarachiyin, sharama hevi divrei Mordechai b'la'achar shaholchu shu haschalas malacha uki kinyan dami. And so you shouldn't have the same duty to mitigate. He says, oh, v'efshar shaschalas malacha kinyan garua hu. So the idea here is to say, remember, we had an open question whether Aschalas HaMalacha is an artificial kinyan to just allow the contract theory to go into effect automatically, or whether, no, that's like the full kinyan. That's how, like the Ramban said, Kshem Shashar Dvarim Niknin Be Kinyan Kach Schiras Poalim Niknin Be Aschalas HaMalacha. Pesach Choshen here is suggesting that Haskalas HaMalacha itself is only a weak artificial kinyan, and therefore we're not fully in contract land, we're in quasi-contract land, so there will still be a duty to mitigate. But in Achanami, had the Balabayas and the Poel made a real kinyan on this transaction of Schiras Poelim, then there would be no duty to mitigate. You see that? So it's important, A, for the distinction between Haskalas HaMalacha and a real kinyan, B, for conceding the Nesivis' point that once there's a kinyan, there wouldn't be the same duty to mitigate. Cool.
I just want to throw that. I find the Nesivis' view astounding, beyond sensational. So the classic case of mitigate is when there's identical labor available, and then it's either for equal wages, in which case it would work for equal wages, for greater wages, in which case fine, or for lesser wages, in which case the previous employer will compensate the difference. That seems like a feature of those seem like consensus principles. What the Nesivis wants us to believe is that the Nesivis basically has to smuggle in a kind of balancing test. Whereby from the Poel's perspective, from the perspective of the contracted worker, the extra labor is worth the extra money. And that's a big assumption, because the extra labor, if you're a school teacher and or a tutor, and the fellow whose daughter you're tutoring in Latin says, my daughter's sick today, you're going to work in my nuclear plant. Or whatever it is, I'm just going to triple your salary. Okay, that's a loss from a certain perspective. Meaning, there's greater exertion involved. It might not be worth it to you. The Nesivis has to assume that, default, whatever extra labor is just worth it to the Poel at whatever extra wages are being offered in return.
Right.
That seems insane to me.
Okay, it's a fair point. I think your comment is more about the duty to mitigate in general as opposed to how the duty to mitigate interacts with the contract theory. Am I right?
My point is about the Nesivis' extension of the duty to mitigate to cases where the labor is more strenuous. Because then what you're basically saying is that the worker, when he signs on to the contract, that he's really not signing up to do that work. He's just signing up to do whatever work of whatever value, or he loses his wage.
Right. Well, that was one day. That's one day in the Ramah.
Definitely a sense in which it would violate the...
Right. That's already one day in the Ramah. Yeah. And the Chaznish already interpreting that said, it's got to be the kind of labor that you normally might engage in. So there is some reasonability.
The Chazanish trims it.
Right. I'm right now more interested in the Nesivis' point that...
It's already the more,
right. Right now I'm more interested in the Nesivis' point that post-Kinyan, you wouldn't have a duty to mitigate. And then the Pesachei Choshen's qualification, well, maybe the distinction between post-Haskalas HaMalacha as a Kinyan and post-real Kinyan. Okay?
But I thought that Nesivis says you... Oh, sorry. I thought the Nesivis says that you do have a duty to mitigate post.
No. The Nesivis says that your duty to mitigate post, you don't have the same duty to mitigate post-Kinyan as you do pre-Kinyan.
Oh.
That's the Nesivis'
argument. I think I'm getting angry about the Mordechai. Okay.
Right, exactly. You're getting angry about the Mordechai, which is one day in the Ramah.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Got it?
Sorry.
Let me just make one further point that, if you look at the bottom of page 20, so remember you have Rashi and Ayin Vav and Beis, this also is a view that may hold that there's no duty to mitigate post-Kinyan. Anybody remember this Rashi? Bottom of 20? So maybe we have, Gabe, do you remember this Rashi? Well, Yoni?
Ramban commented on it.
Yeah, that's right, the Ramban commented on this Rashi. What's interesting about Rashi, Yoni?
Because he has two different parts to him.
Exactly.
Things to say that...
If you could fully mitigate, all there is taromes.
Yeah.
So he says two things, right? Why?
Verses you only have is Torah Metz, the only potential issue, because just Kirasna from Lachir, because you have this duty to mitigate.
That's right, because you could mitigate. And so long as you can mitigate, you have no financial claim. And then he says...
Then afterwards he says that because really there's no Tviyas Mamon.
That's right. There's no Tviyas Mamon. Why is there no Tviyas Mamon?
Because Dvar Ba'amon.
Right, which suggests that it's only pre-Kinyan that the duty to mitigate would exist. Right, so pre-Kinyan, you could say Taskirat Mechem L'Acherim, which is like the Nesivus' point, that in a tort paradigm, we could say, oh, mitigate and you didn't suffer a loss. But that the only reason why you could say that is because it's just Dvarim Ba'alma. But once you enter into post-Kinyan world, then Rashi would say, oh, if it's more than Dvarim, then there's already Tfiyas Mamon, and you can't argue, oh, go mitigate your losses, I'm not chayav to pay you anything. Okay, so these are all possible views. I mean, the Bach is the most explicit, the Sivis is more explicit, Rashi less explicit, that would say, oh, once we're in Kinyan land, you have no duty to mitigate because you're entitled to the contract. Now look, and here's at the page 19, the Chazanish and Bavakama Simon Chav Aleph. So here the Chazanish wants to preserve the contract theory, right? But he wants to explain why there might be a duty to mitigate, even though we're dealing with contract. So Yoni, why don't you read that for us?
Where is this?
Chaznish on page
19.
Come again? Simon
Chafalf, yeah.
So that question is basically asking this question, right? Once there's Haskalas HaMalacha, why should the Balabais be able to back out with no financial penalty if they could mitigate? Halo nischai bischaram. He's chayav to pay their schar. Why should he ever get off the hook? So you see, the Chaznish's question is coming from a strong Kinyan view. Okay. And you blah, blah, blah. And you look in the third line, imkain.
Imkain, kvar shibe nechasev v'chos charam, umlachim shavet purtach hashib kinyan kesef.
Yeah. He's already mishabed himself for their to pay them, and it's chashev kinyan kesef, like Ramban said, right? It's like a transfer of assets. V'yesh lomar,
kevan de lo kani klum k'neged eskirut, einu mitchayev el im yeser lehem imashet pasakim.
So this is his attempt to reconcile the contract view with the duty to mitigate. Kevan de lo kani klum k'neged eskirut, einu mitchayev el im yeser lehem. Mimasha pasaki mahem. What's that idea? See what he's saying?
Even I'm away from my computer. Can you just read the line again?
Yeah. He says, the reason why you have a duty to mitigate is because kivan de lo kani klum k'neged aschiros, and I think what he's saying, since the balabais never got what he wanted in exchange for paying them, eino mischayev, we can't really hold him liable, ela im yachzar lahem mimashe pasak imahem. Unless they end up suffering some sort of loss. So what he's trying to say here, I think...
You don't actually get fully... You don't get full expectation damages.
Well, you do, but only if you can't mitigate. He's saying the duty to mitigate comes out of a fairness consideration for the fact that the Balabais is not getting anything in return for the payment that he's making. So... A background assumption of this whole agreement is that the Balabais was going to get some sort of labor from them, right? It's a two-way agreement. He pays them, they do services. Granted, the Balabais is the one who breached, so he's got to pay them. But it's not fair for him to have to pay in full and not receive any services in exchange. It's also not fair for the Poalim not to receive the amount that they're promised. So the way the halacha sets it up is that, well, let's see if they could... still get out of this without suffering a loss, then we'll let the balabayis off the hook in consideration for the fact that he got nothing in return. If the poalim can't get out of this unscathed, they can't fully mitigate, then we'll put the balabayis on the hook to pay them. So you see, so the chazish is trying to say, yes, it's a contract theory, but because the contract is assuming a bilateral performance, that the balabayis will get something in exchange, so it's just not equitable, it's not fair to make the balabayis pay in full when they're not going to suffer a loss at all. You see that? See, when the Pesach Choshen quotes this, he says...
If it was like a shach, do you also against the bach? Like, then do the poem have the choice here? Do they have to mitigate?
No.
What?
The poem don't have a choice. I think that...
Do the poem have a choice here?
Yeah, they have a choice.
In the Chazanish's world?
Yes.
Sounds like, no, they don't have a choice. Right? So it's a fairness consideration for the balabayis that if they're not going to be chas or anything... because they could just get alternative employment, it's not fair to make the balabayis pay.
But if they don't take it, then they are chaser.
It's interesting. You're saying how we magdir yachsar?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they have a duty to mitigate because they're not providing any service in return. It's not an implausible view, right? I think it makes sense.
No. I don't think it's because they're not providing service in return that there's a duty to mitigate. I think there's a duty to mitigate because I don't think it's the right way to think about it. They can't solicit they can't get compensation. But in other words, the duty to mitigate has no. I know that's the term of art, but it's an ambiguous phrase because they're working for really there's a different principle at work here. The reason why they have to go find work, I think, is because they've already, in a sense, given up their right to this time to labor. And so if there's other labor to be had, their willingness to work means that that they abjure compensation if they don't work. I think that's the reason why they have to go find work. If there's no other work to be had, then it's not their fault and they get compensated. The fact that they gave up their time to work, meaning they signed the contract to work, means that they don't have a claim to compensation if there is work and they don't take it. That's the principle.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hear that as a theory. The language of the Chazanish says, "Kivan de lo kani klum keneged haschiras." What I take that line to mean is that since the balabayas did not receive anything in exchange for paying their schirus, eino mischayev, he can't be held liable, ela im yechzar lahem mimashe pasak imahem, unless he ends up causing them a loss.
Okay, that's a little... Yeah, I mean, he's putting it from the balabayas' perspective, but it's not quite clear what not clear what the worker's duty to mitigate. Okay, fine, then sorry, but the Chazanish is confused. Because conceptually, there is no connection between the balabayas not paying and the workers having to go find other work. It has to do with the worker, not with the balabayas, why the workers have to go find other work. And then if there's no other work to be found, the balabayas is up a creek. He's got to compensate them.
You guys agree with Cole?
There's other work to be found. Don't appeal to... Yeah.
Do you guys agree with Cole? Or...
Understand?
I see what you're getting at. I'm a little more sympathetic. I think that you could say it's not fair for the balabayas to be held liable when he only agreed to pay them on the assumption that he's going to get some service in return. Granted that he breached, still, if they're able to work, then let them work and earn their salary.
What does that have to do with the balabayas?
Is that he really only promised their compensation?
Why do the workers have to avoid the loss? Meaning, like, it's true. If there's a loss to the worker, you're right. If there's a loss to the workers, the balabayas has to compensate them for it. If there's other work, we judge that as not being a loss. Why do the workers have to avoid the loss?
Just because they're not entitled. They're not entitled to a windfall. That's the point. They're not entitled to a windfall.
I'm asking you why. Why are they not entitled to it?
Because the contract, the original contract, because the original contract wasn't issued unequivocally. It was issued on the assumption that they were going to provide some service for him.
Okay, and they don't provide the service because, and they don't provide the service. Why should the existence of other work have anything to do with whether they get compensated?
Because if there's other work, then they're gonna, they're not going to suffer a loss, so they're made whole. They're made whole on their own.
Why do they have to? They're made whole on their. So the way. So I think the. I think the straw. The better way to get that is to say that the workers have no claim to. Maybe we're converging. The workers have no claim on the balabaya. If there's another way. For them to put in some hours and earn wages. But the reason why they have to do that has to be something to do with what they agreed to do in the contract. Meaning, I think they have a demonstrated willingness to work during this period of time. The balabaya deprives them of the right to execute on that willingness if he doesn't give them work and nobody else can give them work. Because he agreed to it. And so if nobody can pick up the slack, he's got to compensate them.
Okay.
But the workers have to pick slack. The workers have to pick it up for themselves. I think that's the best explanation for it.
Okay. I hear that. So Yoni, read for us now the Chazanish starting Ubalabaya Yachalachzar. The last paragraph in the Chazanish.
Okay. Ubalabayit yachol lachzor, ukabel din yada al tachtona, bein bepoal bein bekablan, bizman shmosim lahaskir. The dafka.
So Balabayit could breach, and you know, he'll pay a little bit, yada al tachtona, if they could find alternative employment. But dafka. And this is a very important qualification.
Dafka bizman shapoal itchayev lasam lachto velo kanav gufo. Aval, im hikna gufo bikinyan hamoil, afagab da poal yachol lachzor.
So here the Chazanish concedes the conceptual point that if there was a real kinyan, it's not exactly clear what he means by imhikne gufo bekinyan hamoel. If there's a real kinyan, something that would constitute, I guess, hikne gufo bekinyan hamoel, then, I guess, as opposed to just haschalas and malacha, then the balabayis is chayv to pay their wages in full, even though they could still mitigate. See that? So here the Chazanish concedes the full point that assuming there is something that's a full kinyan aguf, and maybe even just, you know, on the theory that generally schiras poalim is gufo kanoi, like we saw in the beginning of the year, then there actually is no duty to mitigate. In which case the Chazanish would fall, you know, even stronger than that Bach category. Just it's fully their salary and Kenyan implies that there is no obligation to mitigate losses. Yoni.
Well, within this line, it sounds then like if I push back on the previous read, and then like it doesn't, it's, and then the distinction here between whether there is a kinyan gufo or not.
Good.
Sounds like it's not just saying that like the first case was that it wasn't fair, that really they did deserve it, but
there's no kinyan.
It sounds like the argument is that like the contract wasn't like a fully
right. We're in tort land.
Well, it might not be tort land, but the contract might not. And then, like within like the Benson article, like the different patterns to explaining why exactly you would get the expectation damages. So it sounds like that's kind of what he's dealing with, and his argument is that you don't really get expectation damages if you don't have the kinyan, because without the kinyan, then you don't have.
It's just nezek. Yeah, that's right. It's just nezek.
Or it's some type of contract damages, but you also don't already own.
Right.
The expectation.
That's right.
I don't think it's nezek. I think it's just not. There's no contract duty to pay.
It's not yours to lose or something.
As opposed to when there is a kinyan gufo, there it seems more obvious that you would be high for.
Hey, Arius, your argument is that once you see the Chazanish conceding this point at the end, when there's a real kinyan guf, then there's no duty to mitigate, and the earlier passage must essentially hold that this is a non-full Kenyan case, right?
Yeah, there is a Kenyan, but I mean...
It's a weak Kenyan of Ascalas and Malacha. And the weak Kenyan of Ascalas and Malacha is already a kind of maybe tort-like principle or weak Kenyan principle.
Yeah.
Yeah. But assume that the middle ground case, the Ascalas and Malacha case, let's say it's a quasi-contract principle. So then at least we're willing to recognize the duty to mitigate in a quasi-contractual relationship. Right?
Yeah, no, certainly is. I don't think the first view is non-contract. I think it's just not strong.
You're saying it wouldn't go all the way in for that Benson formulation.
That's
his.
That's right. It was like some sort of transference.
Transfer of property.
Yeah. I think that's too strong.
Maskim. I agree with that. Okay, any comments on this part of the analysis? Any other comments on the strong Kenyan view? Anybody?
Strong Kenyan view seems right.
Yeah, you like that? Okay, good. So you see, so it comes out of the Ramban, it makes its way into the Shulchan Aruch, and then I think these Chazanishes with the Bach and the Pesachoshen interpreting that Nesivis, they really move this view and develop it pretty clearly. Right, and the Chazanish thing is the most extreme idea, that it's as if you're being paid out for the actual work, as if you did the work that was contracted. The Chazanish about Biyomo Titin Scharo and Loselin, Batalin, etc. Let me just make one more point about the duty to mitigate. So, look at the Pischei Choshen on page 19. So you see the Pischei Choshen in Sif Yud Zayin. Does anybody see that? Ben, you want to read it for us? Talking about the duty to mitigate.
Which one there?
Sif Yud Zayin. This is the Shulchan Aruch Siman Shin Lamed Gimel Sif Beis. He's talking about the obligation to mitigate. V'hainu shemotzim lehistakir ba'oso schum ba'oso tenayim. Okay.
Moshe is ba'er, afal pi sheitkilu b'malacha, shehu kikinyam is gayim b'hiskara. Kevan shemotzim makum acher lehistakir niftar b'bala ba'es.
Okay, so he's saying, oh, even though there's a Kenyan, you still have a duty to mitigate because they could find alternative. That's not really an answer in my view. But look at the next line. This is the point. So what's that line saying? That there, even though there's a Kenyan, the Baal Bayis should have to pay them, still they have a duty to mitigate. Why? Because, what does that mean? The Baal Bayis, right?
Yeah, like they can
pay
the Kenyan.
Tell us, Ben.
He's able to give them the work of others.
Meaning what? He has the power, as the employer, as the Ofeldian power, to say, great, you finished your work for me. I want you to work for Ben. I want you to work for Yoni now. And recover payment from Yoni and Ben for having his worker provide services for them.
Right.
So the duty to mitigate, as Yoni, I think, actually mentioned earlier in the year, might stem from the general rule that a Baal HaBayis has the power to tell his poel to also work in somebody else's property, right? So it's not really mitigation qua mitigation. It's mitigation qua the original contract that the Baal HaBayis, when he hires you for the day, has the right to say, do this labor or similar labor in somebody else's rishos. Right, Yoni, this is the point you were making a while ago.
Is he quoting someone?
No.
Where does this come from? Like his own
language? Yeah. So we know that in general the Baal HaBayis has the right to tell Paul to work in somebody else's rishus, right? I could be socher you to work bishali and then mara bishal chaver. This we saw earlier in the year.
Seems that the responsibility is on the Baal HaBayis rather than
exactly. The yeah, it's a good point, Ben.
Where does that go, mara?
And I think one second, Cole. I think that's a good nafkamina, right? The Baal HaBayis would have to say, you know, oh, I want you to mitigate by. Say hasker atzmachem, right? We were mesupak earlier in the year. Does the Baal HaBayis have to say this in order for the duty to mitigate to exist?
Right.
Or is it automatic? So if it's a duty to mitigation, because then you didn't suffer any harm, we might say it's automatic. But if it's part of the original agreement that the Baal HaBayis has a right to just tell you what to do, right? He has that Ofeldian power to sign obligations to you, sure. One of which is to work in the neighbor's field, then the duty to mitigate really stems from the powers and privileges that the Baal HaBayis holds through to the original contract. Cole, you asked where that Gemara is. We open the door just a little.
Hot in here, no?
Yeah. Where is that business about renting people out?
What's that? Hamaskir shel chavo shel lo b'hareya b'shel chavero. So the Gemara cited it in the beginning of the parak.
Yeah, yeah. Where?
The Gemara cited it in the first interpretation of Hitu says that. So it came up in our sugya, right? And if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, there's a whole simen, I think, on in Shin Lamed Daled, maybe, that discusses the Baal HaBayis' power to do that.
Okay.
All right. I'll get you the exact Ma'ar Malkam later. But this is another way of making sense of the duty to mitigate and make it consistent with Kenyan. Yoni.
The Pitrei Choshen in that same footnote, so like after...
When he's citing the Chazon Ish?
No, yeah, after the Chazon Ish. You don't have it in your thing. He brings like an interesting nafka mina of what happens if the first employer, right, breaches.
Oh, yeah.
Like on the deal, and then they go to a second employer to like mitigate, and that second employer then also breaches.
So who has the responsibility?
Who now has responsibility to pay, so to speak, for the losses? So he suggests that maybe they can go to either of them. Maybe they go back to the first one. Maybe it's like only the second one. And I think it like really plays into like this question.
Yeah, it might be enough kamina.
Right.
Is it mitam nezek?
Right. So if you think there really was like an extension of the original contract, then it's definitely the first guy. But if there's like some type of like duty to mitigate, it's like a separate din or it's mitam nezek. So probably the second guy is more going to be responsible. Or if it's mitam nezek, actually maybe it's either one. Maybe you can choose.
Yeah, good point. I remember seeing the rest of that har, but I didn't appreciate its significance. Let me add that. Saw that in the rest of the har there. That's a good point. Good. Okay, that's what I wanted to cover in this part of the Kenyan theory of the Kenyan and its relationship to duty to mitigate. So I want to move on now to the Poel Batel discussion. We could do that, right? We could go for another half hour or so? 20 minutes? 15 minutes? Okay, let me pause this for a second.